emergency preparedness exercise, and Director Ken Murphy and Carmen Merlo, I'm doing this without my glasses, from Portland Office of Emergency Management. And we are very happy that you're here and look forward to this. So go ahead and start.
All right. Thank you, Chair Boone and members of the committee. My name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of the Office of Emergency Management for the State of Oregon. And I did provide you some written testimony, and most of it, which I won't go over, is just some background on the exercise, giving you the idea of a little bit about the size and the scope of the exercise. It was the nation's largest exercise, clearly the largest exercise in the state of Oregon. A couple things I just wanted to highlight on page two to give you the context. This was a exercise dealing with radiological dispersion device, and its primary intent of something like that in a terrorism scenario is not necessarily to kill people, but to psychologically and economically damage the area of the event. And the top-off objectives at the top of page two, these were national objectives that somewhat guided how we were going to work, was prevention, intelligence investigation, incident management, public information, and then an evaluation component to make sure that we did this properly to be evaluated. And then right below that were the state objectives. And I just want to review those very quickly. Part of it was to validate the National Incident Management System and more lovingly the Incident Command System to make sure that people, you know, that had never been exposed to that or got more training in it. And then at the time, making sure that we followed the National Response Plan, which has been replaced already by the National Response Framework. Manage fusion center and intelligence information, demonstrate the ability to provide emergency public information to the media and to the public, test and evaluate the effectiveness of radiological plans, procedures, and policies. And we put that one in there because my personal opinion is that a lot of that was there in the civil defense days, and a lot of it's been lost over the years. So I thought it was good, you know, that we would learn more about some of the new issues dealing with radiological types of issues and testing and procedures. Demonstrate public health and medical surge capabilities, and then assess the effectiveness of our plans, policies, and procedures. And then right below that, some gee whiz facts, exercise statistics. You can see that this was a very large exercise. And Oregon had a little over 10,000 people participate in this exercise. And it was very busy, very complicated. And I truly can tell you, personally, it stressed everything to the max. And then we continued the exercise. Immediately after we finished the main exercise, we conducted a recovery tabletop the Monday after the exercise, and then we continued that recovery exercise in December in Washington, D.C. Briefly, just to highlight then some positive comments in the areas that we need improvement on. The top off obviously brought together everybody, you know, and a lot of people that had never really truly participated. And so it was very good, eye-opener, a lot of good training. And I will tell you that the 2 years it took to get ready for this exercise was probably some of the best learning and gaining knowledge other than the week-long exercise itself. Excellent efforts on recovery planning. Governor Kulongowski and the policy advisors got fully engaged in the recovery piece, which led us to some great benefits for the December storms. It was new to a lot of those folks, state agency leaders. They did a great job, a lot of great input, and was very successful, and we're still reaping the benefits of that recovery planning effort. I thought we had a good coordination of flow of information with federal entities operating in Oregon. A lot of times, some of these agencies like EPA, we don't necessarily get to work with all the time, Department of Energy. So we had a lot of new federal partners that we don't commonly work with, and I think that opened some doors for learning and future coordination. planning process was invaluable. Good mutual aid efforts, continuing to improve upon those and how we share things among jurisdictions. Excellent collaboration with the private sector, something that we hope to continue to build on. And I think that we really need to, I would even move that down to needs improvement. It worked well. We just need to continue to build upon that. And then the involvement of policymakers. I'm sure I've testified before this committee in the interim. You can never get the policymakers involved too much. It's always good to expose them to the issues and get them involved. Needs improvement. Better management of the flow of information and communications. My point in that statement is when you get an exercise this big, you get multiple jurisdictions, you have a lot of information and communications, and it is difficult to manage. And I think we need to continue to test ourselves and improve upon that, whether it's between Carmen and I. One thing I've told everybody, even though this exercise was relatively isolated to the greater metropolitan Portland area in the state of Oregon, I always say, what if it was 26 counties and 100 cities? So it's, you know, how to deal with that information and communications flow. We need more exercises and training. We do a lot now, but we need to do more, and they need to be smarter in how we do them. We need a short-term and long-term recovery plan. One of the things in working with the governor's recovery cabinet is trying to institutionalize and put together a plan so that we have a long-term, short-term and long-term recovery plan. I think that's really important and one of my passions. You know, I think our first responders know exactly what they're doing. They do it every day. They're professional. But short-term and long-term recovery, when you talk about the economics of rebuilding cities, counties, special districts, jurisdictions, tribal governments, we need more practice in that. Need to do more training and exercises with public information personnel and media. I would probably put that down no matter what exercise I was talking about. You just can never do enough to teach public affairs people how to coordinate all the information, make sure you have correct messaging, and how to work with the media. So, talking some of the needs, as I always try and bring up, I need more people, really, I think, to conduct exercises and training. When you look at the spectrum of everything across the state of Oregon, the counties, the cities, special districts, public and private things, there's so many opportunities to do more, you know, training and exercises. And I have two people on staff now that do that, and it is just not enough, you know, if we really want to help the state out. And as I testified before, you know, the more of this we can do before the next disaster, the better off we'll be. I also believe that we need more regional state emergency management personnel to be able to be positioned out around the state to help local jurisdictions in whatever way possible. Training and exercise, planning, this is some of the same type of things that I submitted last legislative cycle, you know, that we have personnel that are out there to help cities and counties with their efforts. The other thing that I think that top off right out is we need more people dedicated to planning and logistics. And I probably in my written testimony should have put future planning. When you're in the heat of an exercise or a disaster, you're dealing with the things that are in your face right at that moment trying to help citizens and jurisdictions. The thing that I'm looking at is people to set aside that are not engaged in the current event to be able to plan for the next 24, 36, 48, 72 hours. What is it that we as a state need to do, you know, to better serve the citizens during this disaster? And then logistics. I don't have any personnel dealing with logistics, and it's very important to have people that can plan for how to get commodities, how to deal with logistics distribution, how to make sure that communities and working with the private sector, you know, getting logistics, you know, because everybody needs something, and so it's got to be flown by a helicopter, it's got to be transported by an airplane, it's got to be moved by a truck, and I don't have any of those people to do that, and I think that is something that would be very helpful. The other thing is need more exposure for state agencies working with their federal counterpart. And this is really not a criticism. It's just, you know, we need more of our state agencies, you know, in the disaster mode to be able to work with their federal counterparts, share ideas, share solutions, learn each other's role, especially during a disaster. And we also need a larger, well-trained group of personnel to provide liaison duties. And let me try and explain that briefly. Just simply having, and it can come from state agencies, can come from different sources, but if a jurisdiction needs somebody there representing the state or something else, you know, we could send a person there, you know, that would be that voice or that helpful person to help that jurisdiction, you know, overcome some of the bureaucracy and red tape, if you will, to feed stuff back to the state and help out local jurisdictions with any type of needs. And then finally, need to develop better automation systems, which will provide more detail on overall situational awareness. This is just simply nothing more than good automated systems. If you really want to be able to tell yourselves, the legislature, the governor, policymakers, what's really going on at the ground level. And a lot of times, it's very difficult. Many people will tell you during the flooding in the North Coast, it was very hard to know exactly what was going on. And there's lots of technology out there where you can GPS vehicles, better communication systems, such as Owen, different products like that, you know, that we can provide more reliability, situational awareness, that we can tell our leaders of state government, you know, here's what's really truly going on, and ultimately hopefully help the citizens better knowing exactly what they need. Because when your electricity is out, it's dark, all of those type of scary things, it's very hard to find out what's really going on. So those are the things that we're looking at for improvement, and I'm sure that we'll see some of these come before the 09 legislative session. That's all I have.
Any comments?
Carmen,
yeah, well, I was going to say, if you want to, I was going to respond to a couple of things that you mentioned, Kent, and that is your more personnel to do more training around the state on a regular basis. Kind of like the regional areas, every once in a while a group, and I can only speak for my area, I know it happens around the state too, we'll have all of our South Clatsop County fire departments will get together for a drill that will use somebody coming in from maybe one of your connectors. And these are things that they don't happen often, but when they do, people really appreciate them. And then they can, after those drills, they can practice them again and again until it's just second nature. And that's kind of how I look at this. The need for this is on a bigger scale. And we found this during the flood, things like that, that there were some things that sort of fell into place, and then the ones that needed improvement were pretty obvious, you know, and just one thing he said is getting equipment, commodities, et cetera, foodstuffs for one thing. One of the food center, community centers, had people bringing in food from home, and that was stopped mid-bring-in because they said they're not being produced in a commercially licensed kitchen, therefore they weren't allowed to serve them. And that, you know, for in our area, I have to say, not everybody's perfect in Cannon Beach, but most of them are, and a lot of good cooks too. A lot of people didn't understand that. I mean, I got that and I understood it, but it was very frustrating to the local community that they couldn't serve this food. So that was one thing, and getting things to these small communities in a timely manner, supplies, etc. One of the things that we found was very hard to deal with immediately was getting people to get their prescription drugs or whatever. They couldn't, the power being out, the computers were down, and they weren't allowed to get their prescriptions unless they brought in the bottle, and then they tried everything they could to, you know, comply with law that's existing and to be reasonable too, but there is a point where they had to say, you have to do this, and they couldn't drive through in some areas. So these kinds of, they seem small, but if we plan for them ahead and make things make the emergency, I can't think of the word I need, but anyway, so make it so that the community can respond in such a way that maybe they wouldn't do it on an everyday basis, but only during an emergency. Mm-hmm. And the fact, I did attend the top-off drill one day of the 2 days, and I could not believe how much time, you could tell how much prep time was put into it. And when it finally happened, I thought it went well for what I saw, and I went up to OHSU and watched the cleanup operation and how that went, and talked with some people, some doctors up there who I've become well acquainted with during the month of January and for my problem, and they were very glad to be a part of this, and they hope that more of this happens, because we learn from our drills, and the more you drill, the better you get at it. So,
yeah. My daughter's middle name is Carmen. You know, that I think as I'm listening to you and the good chair, and as I observe all this stuff, before I was put on this committee, emergency response was not. Like in the natural resources sub, I heard from some people about these issues, but I think communicating with the people that sit up here and giving, we're not having a loud enough conversation here, and it's not your fault. I'm not blaming you, but that is a real problem, I think, in this building, first of all, from just a policy perspective, and then it trickles down and flows right into the funding, or essentially the lack thereof. So I think that right, but the public communication part, the idea of not normally or historically communicated agency to agency, either at the state level or the federal level or both, that I think is really huge, and it's a systemic problem in every area of government. But I think when you're talking about people's lives on the line, we really need to work on that, and you've been doing a great job trying to do that, and I commend you. But I was in my truck listening to the radio to a loudmouth commentator, and he was rambling on about how somebody had called him during the flood, couldn't get any fuel, and he came up with this idea, why don't they just drive a National Guard or reserve tanker out there and start pumping people? Well, he didn't take into consideration the fact that maybe there wasn't even a road. And I think that kind of hype, if somehow, I don't know how to fight against that, but I really wish someone had been monitoring that. I should have called in. I wish I had, but it doesn't. And said, look, do you understand the magnitude of these problems? And the truthful answer would be no. But it ain't. And I think having a conversation with the people that own the media and say, please help us. Help us in this dire need. Don't make it worse. Don't spread panic and attack people that are trying out here actually trying to do something like the governor. Now and it would be a simple, cost-free thing to do. Mm-hmm. And it would make a huge difference in this community. Now, the last thing we need to do is inspire people's fear and anger. On the contrary, you got to calm it down, keep our head level. And it just infuriated me when I heard that conversation on the radio. So maybe it's best I didn't call in when I was angry. But once again, expand the conversation in this building, which I think is my job, too. When you come back next year, I would like to hear more, and you'll be able to have a better picture of the benefits from this exercise. I'm not asking you to do it now, but specifically how, and you spelled out here what we have to do better. And then I'm also, next year, I'd also like to hear more about the disaster recovery cabinet and what they're doing and where they're going and how often they're meeting and what they recommend and stuff like that. Don't have to do it now. But I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Yeah. Quick comment, Chair Boone, Representative Schopler. We can do more of this, and I'd also like to fold this in a little bit, too, in our brief discussions with the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, because I think there's a lot of tie-in to that, too. And And I will take advantage and send you stuff on the governor's recovery cabinet. It's readily available, and it'll give you a basic idea of where we're headed with that and what Governor Kulongowski and his policy advisors are looking at. And, you know, and again, I think if we can keep that moving, that will really serve the citizens of the state of Oregon, because a lot of that is what can we do to help them the quickest regain normalcy, whatever that may be, and start the economic engine running, whether it's dollars for them to spend at the local economy or if it's putting businesses back or whatever the case may be. Because in most disaster scenarios, the quicker you can bring calmness and hope and things getting back to normal, I mean, it will happen, and people will, out of the goodness of their heart, you know, they will be there swamping mud out of businesses and doing stuff, and those are the things that bring a community back together the quickest.
You bring up a really good point, Ken, and that is the once the physical cleanup is engaged and going on, that's something people can do immediately, and it's the after. I got calls at home from people, and they just start crying in the middle of it, and it was so hard on them, and everybody was just devastated by the huge expansive damage that was so visible, and it's still visible in our area, and I think that there are still people suffering from some, you know, delayed reaction to it now that things are fairly normal. But that's so true. The recovery cabinet is one of the best ideas I've ever heard of, and it keeps people in there. Local people are engaged in it too, and they can bring forward to the cabinet what their needs are now and maybe in the future. And in the aftermath of all this, people have been thinking about, you know, how things might be better, and, you know, this is better than it was in 96 now, and then hopefully we won't have this happen again soon or anything, but it may, and other things may happen. But the more people, you know, learn from this, they can apply to the next problem. And everybody has learned one of the biggest pluses of all this is, you know, you might not know who your neighbor is. You might drive past their driveway and never really see them more than just in passing. But when things get bad, you know, that's what brings neighbors together and whole neighborhoods. I mean, if you'd gone downtown, that's how far as I could get was Seaside and Cannon Beach. I mean, it was kind of like summer block parties. And, you know, people were taking care of each other. And if they hadn't seen their neighbor in a couple of days, they went over and actually knocked on the door and you know, checked on people. And it just came down to that basic level. And that's kind of been our message locally, is neighbor to neighbor, house to house, to help people. For example, the tsunami preparedness program is that basic. It's just neighbor to neighbor, know what you need, get your little pack ready, and know where to go, and make sure that your buddy's there, has something, you know, what they need. So
I'll go check on the talk show hosts.
Okay, you do that. So, and I'm glad to hear that. And Ken, I'm glad to hear you're not shy about mentioning the need for personnel, because it's
absolutely
not going unnoticed. So,
Chair Boone, and just for a highlight, and this is not personnel, but I'll get you copies. You know, speaking of the media, Representative Shoffler, we just finished a new tsunami media guide for the media to try and help them understand and how they can help during a tsunami. And we've been working with them very closely, one of the members on my staff, and I think it's a great product. Obviously, shameless, you know, plug for my folks, but it's a great tool. And, you know, the perfect world would be nice to have those kind of tools for, you know, earthquakes, different types of disasters, you know, how the media can be part of the solution.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Instead of announcing there's going to be a 50-foot wave and all the surfers are going west and everybody else is going east. So, welcome, Carmen.
Thank you, Chair
Boone, for coming today.
Thank you. And for the record, I'm Carmen Merlo. I'm the director of the Portland Office of Emergency Management. And I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you about Top-Off. You know how sometimes it takes company coming to do some pretty serious house cleaning? Well, we knew we had we were going to host a very large party, and so we did some pretty major house cleaning. And so things like reviewing our paging lists for notification and call-outs. We had people on our paging lists that were retired, that were no longer working for the city of Portland, that shouldn't have been on the paging lists, and people that should have been on there that weren't. So reviewing paging lists that we had. Reviewing our plans. We literally had plans that no one knew about. No one knew what their roles and responsibilities were, and so testing those plans and doing tabletop exercises with them. How to use equipment. We bought a lot of equipment under the Urban Area Security Initiative grant, equipment for law enforcement, for fire. We wanted to make sure everyone knew how to use that equipment, particularly for this scenario, which was a radiological dispersal device. And then, of course, just planning with both our internal and external stakeholders. It was something that we hadn't done to that extent in a very long time. So we did do a lot of things right. We did a lot of things wrong. And some of the things that we did do right, first and foremost, was the use of our new crisis communication software tool, which is called WebEOC. What I heard that from previous exercises was that people didn't have a really good common operating picture, common understanding of what was going on. So some people had some piece of the information, others had a different piece. No one had the same similar knowledge of what was going on. What this did was it was focusing people into one place for all their information needs. And we had the ability to both post information and then also to just extract reports out of it. So it was providing people with a common operating picture. Another success was the use of our GIS folks in our ECC, and everything from finding out what was in the hot zone, what properties, what populations, who we needed to evacuate, finding the best evacuation routes, really visually adding life to written information. And then just giving us a laundry list of things that we had to improve on, and believe me, that was a pretty big list that we came up with. Ken mentioned a lot of what didn't go right, and I'll just very quickly touch on those. The first big thing that went wrong was the public messaging piece. It was very slow to ramp up, and we never quite recovered from the slow start. We just didn't get enough information out, and we didn't get it out often enough. And the mayor in particular got called on a lot to either verify or dispel some rumors that were out there. We should have had people, just like Representative Schaffler pointed out, monitoring the media and calling people out if there was rumors out there that needed to be dispelled, and we didn't do that. So public messaging was really one of our downfalls. I think the second biggest one was we had a large difference of opinion of our subject matter experts. We had county and health and state health folks disagreeing on the best course of action, and that caused hours in delays for evacuation. People didn't know whether they should be sheltering in place, evacuating, and everything just stalled until our subject matter experts came to agreement. I think in the future, disasters is really no time for unanimous decisions. It really needs immediate action. So we need to push top officials to make a decision when no new information will change the quality of their decisions.
Amen to that.
Ken mentioned this, but I want to reiterate this. It really forced us to look beyond just the response phase and more towards the recovery. Our fire and police folks, they did a great job. They knew what they were doing. They do this stuff every day. But it was really more the recovery piece. How do you decontaminate bridges and roads? How do you decontaminate buildings? How do you dispel people's fear about coming back to live and work in the city of Portland? The tourism industry is going down the drain. People's home values that were in the hot zone now worth nothing. I mean, it was a very huge psychological and economic impact to the city that people just hadn't considered the consequences. I think having it be a multi-day exercise was really beneficial, too. I think a lot of the exercises we're used to are just one day in length. Didn't really test people's ability to work long hours for multiple days. I was working 18-hour days for 4 days, and I can tell you I wasn't functioning very well after the third day. So we learned that people's exhaustion is something to take into account, and we're now shifting from 12-hour shifts to either 8 and 10-hour shifts instead. Developing incident action plans. People were only focused on the immediate here and now, and we needed extra people to think about, okay, we're taking care of this in the immediate time frame. What needs to be done in the next 12 hours, in the next 24 hours, and making sure that was being taken care of. Also transferring responsibility of the event from police and fire to more of economic recovery bureaus in the city of Portland. So our revenue bureau, our land use and planning bureau, our economic development bureaus. It wasn't just a police and fire event, but it turned into one, and it should have been more of a shared responsibility. One of the things that we're doing in pursuit of some of our lessons learned is trying to find a co-located city-county emergency coordination center. We had way too many emergency operation centers up and running. And what that caused was both a delay in the response phase, but also a lack of coordinated information and messaging out to the public. So we had to find staff to go to all these different emergency operation centers and then make sure we were all on the same page. We had our subject matter experts in this location. We had our public officials in this location. It just didn't work out at all. So we are now in the process of pursuing a co-located city-county EOC. We have a site found, but now we're trying to pursue some funding for it. We also found that we had a lot of people in our ECC that were really only there because they were appointed there. They were told to go there. And we needed more than just a warm body in there. And so we are now rethinking how we staff and train our EOC responders and doing a better job of making sure they're a more of a specialized team as just opposed to a team that comes out when they're called upon once every 10 years. So that for us was some of the big lessons learned. It's not rocket science, but it is something that we need to do a better job at. So I want to echo Ken's need for staff. We do look to OEM for leadership, and they just don't have enough people on board to help us do some of these things. So anyway, that's my testimony.
Thank you. Rep. Shoffler.
You know, the more you sit here and talk about this, this is just so, it touches everything, every part of life. Now imagine you have a young family, and they get out, and they're safe. I'm going to be real positive here. But they got student loans to pay of their own, a mortgage, they have children that they want to send to college someday. Their house is now worthless.
Right.
All their assets have been wiped out.
Right.
Now, they go, now essentially they have nothing, yet they still have this incredible debt. We talk a lot about debt these days. I mean, are we going to just say, what are we going to, I mean, it just touches everything, but that narrow little window, and when you talk about the recovery of a community.
Exactly.
I mean, have you even looked at that? What does the bank and the financing industry, which I'm going to go talk to at 11 o'clock, I'm going to ask them this question, and I have to leave early, forgive me. But that it's just something that popped in my head. What are we doing in that area as far as recovery goes?
Just quickly, yeah. With Chair Boone, Representative Shoffler, insurance companies don't have terrorism as a covered event. So they're out of luck, basically.
Yeah. Chair Boone, Representative Shoffler, we're starting, but we're a long, long, long ways away because recovery touches everything, just like you said. It's actually quite frightening how many things, and you know, and people start learning how dependent our society is on so many different pieces and how everything is interconnected and the interdependencies. And we've done some discussions with a lot of the industry, like banking, but also it's just a long ways away, and how to bring that all together, you know, where you have a coordinated effort for recovery, you know, to take into account that family. And maybe it's that family, their house was okay, but where they work got destroyed, and they're still in the same situation.
Man.
That's a good point. I'm glad you're bringing that up. Because it's beyond their control, just like a natural disaster, which we did pass a bill. One of Rep. Witt's bills, but you can't, insurance companies can't cancel a policy, or if you can't pay the premium during the event, you have an additional 30 days, and they make it from after the event.
My wife's business. I mean, if it was in the epicenter of one of these, what in the world would we do?
Right.
Hopefully by then legislators will be making living wage and
give her a little time off. Well, that was a good point. Those were some of the first calls we received as legislators. And my first one came from a woman who worked either in the Tillamook Food Bank or with someone who worked there, and they had the questions from once they got things up and running and open. People said, what do we do about our pay? They're, you know, minimum wage workers, depending on a paycheck, and they were out of work because their business, place of business was closed or destroyed or whatever, and that is another bill that we worked on this week. So we're trying to do that, and that's a natural disaster. This terrorism thing is just as bad, if not worse, but when it's not covered by insurance, that really puts people in a pickle.
Yeah.
Well, Rep. Cowan, welcome. You missed a lot, but that we have some, if you have any questions of either Ken or Carmen.
I think it might be a little unfair to start with some questions. Could you take it from the top?
No. Yeah.
I apologize. No. I had to be over at the only place we have to gather groups of people at this particular point in time. So the seniors who are here for Senior Advocacy Day are gathering over at the convention center. So it takes a little more orchestration.
Yeah. Chair Boone, members of the committee, I did send you the 37-year disaster history chart for Oregon. So
thank
if there's
you.
Any question that if it'll happen again, I'm pretty safe in telling you it will.
Yeah. I've got mine, so thank you. And I appreciate all you do. We did ask early on. We asked Ken, you know, could you send us that? Could you send us this? And finally, he just said, I can send you a lot of things. So we get a lot of things from him. And my list, my to-read list is growing. But, you know, I need things to do on the weekend. So this isn't an unusual session for, you know, a lot of reasons and a lot of applications. And it's been difficult. Representative Krieger has the distinction of being the only member of the legislature who had he has two committees meeting at the very same time, and both very important to him. So he flips between this committee and his other committee, and it's I'm sure it's frustrating for him too. So we have a lot of things happening at the same time. It's hard. So I hope people don't think we're being rude when we leave. And it's only because they know that I'll get them later, but they know that they can leave for legitimate reasons, and nobody leaves for illegitimate reasons.
I'm going to storm out on Lindsay Ball at 11 o'clock.
He's already told me that. So.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Appreciate you coming. So now we're going to have a report, and much awaited report, on Owen from none other than Mr. Owen himself, Lindsay Ball. And welcome. And thank you for coming. Thank you very much for coming on such short notice.
Well, that's not a problem. I have this down pretty well.
Good.
You have a handout before you today. My name is Lindsay Ball. I work in the governor's office assigned to the Owen Project. You have a handout in front of you today that is titled Oregon's Public Safety Communications, and it has a panoramic view of a mountain and a radio tower on the right-hand side. And I use that as an introduction. Our radio sites are high elevation, high power output, so they cover a wide geographic area. That picture itself shows some of the geography we have in Oregon, and it's important for us to use the high elevation areas so we can get the widest amount of coverage that we can. Radio is line of sight. If you can't see it, if there's an obstruction in the way, the radio wave doesn't penetrate it. And so that is essentially the law of physics behind it, if you will. The topics I'm going to cover today will be the federal mandates, the status of the Oregon state-owned communication system that we have today, proposed consolidation of four state radio systems into one, and the public safety technology trends. and a comparative cost to the seven Northwest counties, and also the recent development in the last couple of weeks of the Southwest seven counties in conjunction with the Northwest seven counties. If we don't do anything, if we stay with our present status quo, we're going to have a greater opportunity for system failure, which may lead to the public not receiving the services that they enjoy today. Loss of federal funds due to non-compliance of federal mandates. Failure to give public safety personnel the available tools for productive and safe operations, given the technology we have today versus what we currently have in the system that we use day to day. Extended outages due to lack of spare parts. Now, I think most of you have probably heard that we buy spare parts that are used because you can't buy new parts because they don't manufacture them anymore. That's absolutely true. I have staff over at Owen that surf eBay every week looking for parts. And so we can stockpile used parts to keep the system we currently have running. That says volumes in itself. Higher risk of no communications during a critical event, limited operability and interoperability, and increased operations maintenance staff. And if we would consolidate, we would maintain one system versus the four systems we have today. Slide four just shows you a picture of a communications building. Once again, high elevation. It shows you some of the weather that those sites endure, and also the complications we have of getting staff to them if something happens to break down. You'll see a snow cat on this fifth slide that moves up to a radio shack on top of a mountain. Again, the same thing on six. On seven, please note the power line that's in the picture. Each one of these sites has to have a power system. And consequently, if the public utility system goes down, there has to be a backup. You'll see those backups on page 8 and 9. A battery pack can be used as well as a generator and or both. To give an example of that redundant system, how it helped in the December 2nd, 3rd storm on the coast in 2007, one tower lost the power from the public utility. The generator did not activate, but the battery pack came on and was able to operate the tower for 5 days, 5 to 7 days, giving a maintenance crews ample time to get to the site to get the generator up and running. Slide 10 is a picture of a tower that we currently have on Neocony Mountain. Please note in reference to the previous pictures of towers, they're metal, they're state-of-the-art, industry standard. The tower we have on Neocony is wooden, does not meet standards whatsoever. To kind of give you an idea of the strength that tower has to have, in 150-mile-an-hour wind with a full load of microwave dishes, antennas, potential ice load, that tower can't twist more than 1 degree to industry standards. The microwave itself is 1.4 degrees, and so if it moves beyond that, then you lose the microwave connection, that link. So that tower has to be extremely sturdy. And, industry standard, 1 degree twist. This is all that's allowed. I have a map of Oregon, just for your reference. Think about the state, the geographic regions that we have. We have several mountain ranges, watersheds that are quite large with deep canyons, ravines that can block a radio wave. And we get to the federal mandate. What really caused all this to start with? Well, we say it's a federal mandate, but really it's what society has done and the communications industry. I suspect most everyone behind the dais has a cell phone that uses bandwidth. Bandwidth is what radio waves are. And the demand being placed on bandwidth today is higher than it's ever been in the history of mankind, you might say. I think we've all enjoyed being able to send pictures, talk on the cell phone, but send pictures. We've also been enjoying watching video, all by wireless, your computer's wireless. That all takes up bandwidth. And so what has happened is the Federal Communications Commission, as a result of the industries, communication industries and communication industries coming forth saying we need more, technology's caught up by going to a computer-aided radio system or digital. You've been able to squeeze the bandwidth down but actually increase the capacity for that bandwidth. And the Federal Communications Commission has then permitted that bandwidth to go to auction for use by commercial providers. And so that's what's caused the Federal Communications Commission to pass a law that causes everyone to go from wideband to narrowband. And that tightening of that bandwidth is required so that there can be more bandwidth freed up for society to use in their wireless communications today. So on page 12, it shows how we are now currently going to narrowband. In addition to that, the Federal Communications Commission has said, and it's in law, that we will be moving to very narrowband. So this is just the first step. Technology will drive us to a point where we go to very narrow band, which will have to be digital, and they will free up more bandwidth for use in other areas. Now, narrow band, everyone has to go to narrow band by 2013. All frequencies below 512 megahertz, which is 90% of the Oregon public safety, your public utilities, business industries, etc., fall into that, so everyone has to change. The impacts are that you have reduced coverage at the same cost. Older than 10 years old, systems will be incapable of going wideband to narrowband. On January 1st, 2011, the mandate requires that it will be illegal to sell radios that can work in wideband. So you won't be able to buy a wideband radio. You'll have to go to narrowband. So that's ensuring, the Federal Communications Commission is ensuring that everyone makes the transition. So they're pretty serious about this. The impact is, why keep reinvesting in a non-digital system when we know that digital is coming? And then, of course, we go to very narrowband, and that is when we have to be digital. The state status today, we have an aging infrastructure. Our present technology came about and was born in 1945. The four agencies that have systems in Oregon are all analog. Excuse me, are all analog. They are not digital today. We're buying used parts to repair the system, and we have a limited microwave backbone capacity. And our current analog system will carry 420 voice lines. If we go to digital under the new system, we will have 2,016 voice lines. Currently, analog, which the system is that we are on, will not provide data. In other words, we cannot send a picture. We cannot send information on driver's licenses, warrants, wants, all those kinds of things. That data cannot be transmitted over analog. And if you stop and think about that for a moment, how many people transfer a picture on their cell phone? We can't transfer pictures of suspects on the public safety network we have today. So society has moved well beyond where we are providing services to our public safety people. Page 15 gives you the coverage that state forestry enjoys, which is 40%. 16 shows that ODOT has 64%, state police on 17 has 75%. When we combine the four systems into one, all will enjoy an 80% coverage of the state of Oregon. There are nearly 11,000 users of radios by state agency personnel. There is 5,800 mobiles, 6,800 portables as a point of reference as to the volume of use in state government. If you take a look at page 20, that shows a site that we share in Columbia County, telephone poles, which don't meet the industry standard for a tower. Another site down in Curry County has a guy-wired tower. It uses solar panels as well as a backup of propane. You see the two tanks out in front to run a generator for power. 22 shows a site over in Union County that has quite a snow load on it. I would want to point out that is that again is a guy-wired tower. In other words, it's just a steel structure with guy wires that hold it in place. The bad thing about that is if one of those nearby trees was to happen to fall on one of the wires, the tower comes down. I think everyone recognizes what trees do to things when they fall on the coast. Also, a guy-wired tower requires more maintenance. You have to make sure the tension on the wires are routinely checked, etc. What we need in a system is expanded radio coverage, capacity, and redundancy. We want to be trunked digital to enhance public safety capabilities. Data coverage at all Oregon sites, so we can start transferring pictures, data of fire maps, those kinds of things. Expandable standards-based radio and microwave systems, capacity for supporting potential local partners, as well as for growth of state agency requirements. The system that we're planning to put in, or proposing to put in, trunked digital, would allow local governments to become part of the system. And we would have the capacity to carry their needs as well. And a reliable infrastructure. Currently, as I said, our system is not reliable with the age in the state of disrepair. It's a land mobile radio proposal. It's the only technology used by all 50 states in their public safety radio systems. It's used for mission critical voice and data communications. In a mission critical environment, public safety communications must work. A land mobile radio system was the only thing that stood up to the recent storms on the Oregon coast. Katrina, the 911 event in New York, five hurricanes in Florida, bridge disaster in St. Paul, and the firestorm in Southern California are recent events where the digital microwave system, land mobile radio, stood up. 25, I think we've touched enough on analog versus digital. You can see for yourself the advantages of the digital over the analog. What other states are doing, to kind of give you a cost comparison, Michigan spent $300 million on their interoperable effort, Mississippi $200, Colorado $135. But I want you to note Colorado followed the highway coverage, their transportation system. I don't think that would work very well in Oregon with the many rural areas that we have that we often have to have radio communication in. Just think about some of the search and rescue issues that we would run headlong into. Ohio, $275 million. Might note, too, Mississippi was $200 million, but it's half the size of Oregon, and their highest peak is 800 feet. And just think about the geographically diverse state that we have. We have to have more towers, more infrastructure to deal with that. New York New York signed a contract with a private provider, a 20-year period, $2.1 billion. Pennsylvania is looking at $300 million, Florida, $340, and our neighbor to the state of Washington is in a planning phase at this time. And then what was offered to us as a suggestion and a recommendation by a legislative work group last October was that we take a look at the Northwest counties so we could start getting a cost comparison with what we could do by forming partnerships with local government and then forming partnerships with private industry and sharing sites and towers. And so as we got that direction, we then pursued analyzing what could be done in the Northwest seven counties. We minimized the cost through partnerships. We minimized the number of sites but would still reach state coverage goals. We would use the metro trunking system for Owen, as well as the counties of Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah. And we would use the Federal Engineering Conceptual Design 700 megahertz in metro and VHF in the coastal counties, and we would disregard site ownership. In other words, we didn't care who owned the site. We would just evaluate whether or not we could use the site and see what the cost savings would be afterwards. The results of that, after we did that evaluation, we would save $42 million in the Northwest counties in the metro area by partnerships alone with local governments. Now, we haven't looked at partnerships with private industry yet. That's yet to come. Then, in addition, what took place was 3 weeks ago, we were approached by the Southwest seven counties to do something similar with them that we've done in the Northwest. And the Southwest counties have a little bit different situation because they have a grant that was provided to them through Congressman DeFazio, about a $9 million grant, that they would be given to create interoperability between the Southwest seven counties. The problem that they're experiencing is with timber revenues falling short in those areas, they don't have the money to own or operate the system, but they do have the grant money. They came to us and offered to coordinate a build-out of Owen in the Southwest seven counties, and once that build-out occurred in conjunction with the Owen concept, they would give us the infrastructure of the $9 million that would be built by the $9 million, and then we would incorporate that into our Owen project. Excuse me. And then we would share sites with them between the state and the county. It looks very, very promising. We then had the Northwest 7 and the Southwest 7, and then we had Lincoln County in the middle. And it wasn't included in either one of the two proposed plans.
We stand alone. Oh, there's a reason.
But until yesterday, I hadn't made any contact with Lincoln County for a couple of reasons. Let me explain why. I'm very familiar with Lincoln County. We have been working with them with respect to the Owen project, and they have been a supporter. And so I knew it wasn't a problem. We just had a lot of work to do trying to get the Northwest and Southwest organized so we could start to see what it looked like. But I talked with Sheriff Dotson yesterday, and he said, you got to get over here and include us because we're currently building our budget, and we need to find out what Owen might do and what we might need to do. And I said, well, we've identified two sites in Lincoln County that we need to link the Northwest and Southwest together, and then we'd have a full leg down the coast. And so we will be meeting with the people in Lincoln County in the very near future and getting those arrangements in process. So that's what's taking place. We did go before full Ways and Means Committee last night. We did ask for $76 million in COP funds to be set aside without limitation to be spent, because I'm not prepared to spend money yet because I don't have my plans formulated and as well as I would like to come into the legislative body and say, give me money. I'm not there yet. And so what took place, in order for us to start construction this coming summer, the Legislative Ways and Means Committee set aside $76 million for us to come back in with plans by June to go in front of the emergency board, and at that time, with the documentation, our hope is that we would be allowed that limitation, the bonds would be sold, we would then have the revenue to start construction. And that construction realistically probably would start about the 1st of August. It would take about, we project about 16 months for a build-out of the first phase. And that phase current proposed phase would run from the Dalles to Bend to Klamath Falls, and from that Central Oregon line to the coast. And the build-out of infrastructure would consist of towers, radio buildings, and microwave. We would not install radios in at that time. We need a facility to put radios in to start with, and so our proposal is to build the infrastructure first and then to acquire radios after that. It would go into another phase. There would be two more phases that would take in the rest of Central and Eastern Oregon to complete the project by 2013.
Did you say it starts August of this year? Or is
August of 08.
08, okay. Thanks.
And I'm saying August of 08. Once we would be receive the limitation, it would take 45 days, we figure, before we can actually get construction on the ground.
Rep. Callan. Thank you. Thanks for being here. A couple of questions. We talk about local partnerships. Usually that translates to the locals put up a chunk of money. And I think that in the current world with the challenges to county governments, because most of this, not all of it, but city and county, but there's challenges in that. I'm pleased to hear about the grant money that's in place so that the Southwest region might be able to participate. But do you have any feel at all early on as to what kind of local contributions are going to be needed to make this project go in the region that you're working with now?
Chair Boone, Representative Cohen, what we're going to see is a kind of a mixed affair. And let me explain by example. When we approached Washington County, Multnomah County, Clackamas, and the City of Portland, and we evaluated their current radio infrastructure, comparing that to the coverage we would need, the current sites that they have in place, towers, buildings, infrastructure related to that, those sites are a perfect match for the coverage that we would need in Owen. In talking with them, they have told us verbally, none of this has been on paper yet, but verbally they've told us, all we need you to do is just bring your equipment, bolt it in, and we're good to go. They have the capacity for us in their infrastructure. Now that saves the state a lot of money. And what we would do to be working in conjunction with them is that we would put a controller in that costs quite a bit of money. Mm-hmm. But that controller would allow those people in the county and the metro area to be able to use our system, as we would then be able to use their system, from the 800 megahertz frequency to the 700 megahertz frequency. So there is some in-kind contributions there from both sides that creates more capacity for them, because they would be able to easily move onto our system once their system became overburdened, and vice versa. Or if their system broke down, they could use ours and we could use theirs if ours broke down. Now let's just compare that to Clatsop County. Clatsop County doesn't even have a microwave system. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done in Clatsop County. Tillamook County's in better shape. They have a microwave system, as does Lincoln County. So I think you're going to find it's going to be a bit of a mixed bag as to how much local governments can contribute to the system, looking at it on a statewide base.
And just so I make sure I understand part of what you just said, then even those that you basically just bolt in your equipment, there may be radio upgrades and stuff that the locals will need to do within their own system to work together with you. Obviously, I'm not the techno wizard here. I'm making that real clear, I can tell. But
there will be radio upgrades required in some instances. Other instances, there won't be.
Okay. And I think to make sure that we don't leave the impression that Lincoln County was just sort of sitting out there, not participatory
process.
Because I have a little closer familiarity with that area, there's been a great deal of work being done locally over the last few years to make sure that we in Lincoln County haven't had the problems that some other jurisdictions have experienced in that one, that the road department can't talk to state police or our local responders. There's been the interoperability capability built up within Lincoln County's responders for some time now, and they just tested that. They just did a test recently that I unfortunately was tied up in Salem and couldn't go and watch, which I understand went really well. So I guess if a local jurisdiction has done a lot of that local work already, I'm hoping that means that they'll be kind of ready to connect in with the statewide system that's obviously necessary a little more simply, maybe.
Chair Boone, Representative Cohen, there's a couple of things. As we approach this, we're not dictating that local government needs to be in the state system.
I understand.
If they choose to be, the door's wide open.
They need to be, so I'm just kind of trying to think what the impact is. And I understand it'll vary from local government structure to local government structure.
Right. But what I'm saying is, if a local government, city, county, wants to ride the state system, mm-hmm. we can afford that to them, mm-hmm. because the state system would have the capacity to accomplish that under a digital trunk system.
Got it.
If they want to maintain their own system, that's fine with us, too. In that situation, what I ask is, then let's share the same towers mm-hmm. and the same buildings so that we don't build, as I say, dueling towers on the same site. And honestly, the most expensive part of this system that creates the most headache and the most expense is the site itself. And if we have existing sites that the county or the city or the state own, then let's pool our resources. And we can put most everyone on one tower. And then maybe have room for private enterprise to be on that same tower. Or we build a tower so we can accommodate private enterprise. Because if we're going to build out a statewide network, there are places where private enterprise cannot afford to put a structure in, but if we are, for the sake of public safety, and they can become part of the system, you know, having some antenna on a tower that we own, and we can then get private enterprise into rural Oregon, so that rural Oregon can receive the same benefits of the, you know, metro and urban areas. We should do that.
Okay. Thank you. That helps me. I know we have a site in Lincoln County, and that we've actually done that partnership with private enterprise and a few folks that have installations up there. And let's face it, in the rural counties, there's only a few places you can put these things.
Right.
You know, the top of the right mountain is, mm-hmm. is limited, so I have no idea where it fits into this series of pictures about what the structure is, but it's good to know that we can work with upgrading existing sites. And
well, to give an example, currently we're talking with a private vendor on the Neoconi site, mm-hmm. and the private vendor came to us and said, "We want on your site," and we said, "It's a wood structure. It's you don't want to be on the site." And so the private vendor has offered to assist. They've done some of the architecture work on site. They have proposed four different plans of architecture for Neoconi, and they have voiced that they would like to be a partner in the construction. Interestingly, the same private vendor has a site that, if we build out the northwest seven counties as we have identified, they have a site that we'd like to share with them. So if they can share our site and we can share their site, we ought to be able to work something out. And it saves me, if I have to build a new site, it costs them $500,000. And if I can save $500,000, I think that's prudent.
That's good.
Well, we've come a long way from the very beginning of this process.
Well, this has
been very innovative.
This was a helpful update.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we look forward to you coming back again as things move forward.
If anyone ever has any questions or anything, don't hesitate to call, because one of the things that I found is most difficult with a communication system is just that, we need to communicate as to how it's going to come about, how it is going to look, how it's going to be governed, and the cost associated with it. And is it more tedious to form partnerships? I think everyone would agree yes. But the payback in those partnerships far outweighs the work of putting them together. I mean, this is the only way to approach this, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and we're really glad that you've done this. And if I could ask, when you do have an update, just go ahead and send us, you know, if you have something sendable in that sense, or if you think it's the plan should be to come back again and present where you are, we'd love to have you.
Absolutely.
I will do that. One other thing I want to leave with you as a thought, and it's going to take some work between the Owen project and legislators, and I'm really adamant about this. The one thing that has hurt us in the past is that we have not had sufficient funds for our deferred maintenance account. We have not maintained our systems and have no account, no deferred maintenance account, any place to maintain it. And as we look at this and we create partnerships, there will be some opportunity to generate some assessments or lease agreements, etc. And we haven't devised the specifics of such a deferred maintenance account yet, but I would like for people to think about the spirit of putting together a deferred maintenance account so we will have money available in a statutorily dedicated account that we can tap into to maintain the system. And if we would do that, I don't think we would find ourselves in the same situation that we are in today, with a system that's outdated, that has fallen down around us, and the secure communications would then once again be secure.
And that's a very good point. The Rural Policy Advisory Office has has come forth with a recommended list of deferred maintenance and infrastructure systems around the state. The OECD had identified that as one of the top needs. It's a huge cost if you took what we have now and what they need. And so if we take that into account when we start a system or start putting together something that we're going to need, I mean, it's like building a house. You need to maintain it.
I just want to see if I heard what I think I heard, too. Obviously, if you don't have ongoing maintenance, mm-hmm. you get deterioration, and then we have huge costs to fix. But I think you referenced something about fees that, or some sort of funding that might be generated as you go through this process. And maybe I'm jumping ahead, but were you thinking in terms of having the ability to put some income that might be generated in and make sure it's secured in a deferred maintenance account?
What my concept is simply to take revenue that is generated from a lease to a private vendor or assessment from local governments, that some part of that be set aside for in a deferred maintenance account.
Good point. And
it's not that the state has to run on a profit.
Right.
So I think we can come up with a fair and reasonable assessment or lease, but we do have to maintain the system, and it does have to be operated. And I think that we can come up with some type of a fair proposal if people would know that money would be going to a deferred maintenance account. They would support it. And let me just give you an example. We have a private vendor that wants to be part of the system and wants to get into rural Oregon where we're going to build a tower so they can broadcast whatever it is they might broadcast. If they know that our system is going to be maintained for the next 20 years, I would think they would be more apt to want to be part of the system too. And so there's some assurance for the private enterprise to want to be in the system, because they would know that the lease or the assessment, whatever we come up with, that money would be going into a deferred maintenance account that would assure reliability. So I think it works both ways.
Understood. That's what I thought I heard. I just wanted to make sure I was understanding it correctly.
Lindsay, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Yep.
And I will come back anytime.
Okay. Thank you. There's no further business. We'll stand adjourned.
Lindsay?